Good evening, and welcome to tonight's meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California, the place where you're in the know. I'm Dr. Barry Zevin, clinical lead for the San Francisco Department of Public Health Transgender Health Project, and your moderator for tonight's program. You can find the Commonwealth Club online at commonwealthclub.org. Tonight's discussion is the Affordable Care Act and the LGBT community, generously underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. While we will be discussing a number of very important issues tonight, our overarching theme for the program will be the Affordable Care Act, which has provided over 30 million more Americans with health insurance and the effect that the ACA has had on members of the LGBT community, particularly for those who are transgender. To address these issues, we turn to our panel of three experts in the medical field. First, we have Elizabeth Sequeira, nurse and clinic director for Lion Martin Health.
Hey, hello.
Next, Dr. Maddie Deutsch, and clinical lead for the Center of Excellence for Transgender Health at UCSF.
Hello.
And Anand Kalra, program manager at the Transgender Law Center.
Hello.
Please join me in welcoming our panelists. I'm going to start with some questions for the panel, and then I hope that people will submit some questions, and we've got a whole lot of expertise here tonight. To start with, we know that for healthcare to be successful, services need to be accessible and acceptable. The Affordable Care Act has increased access for many LGBT people. Can you comment on what you've seen in terms of increased access, as well as whether this is making care more effective?
I will start. And first, I would like to define access for folks. There's two ways of really looking at access. One is really, we have appointments sort of thing. I want to see a doctor, and I get to see a doctor. And when you look at access for the GLBT community, there is another level that can exist, and it can exist for other communities as well, of, am I going to be met with phobias at this clinic? Am I going to be seen for who I am? Am I going to be discriminated against? And even making that initial phone call to a provider can be very worrisome for many clients because you can hit those barriers right from the initial phone call with folks. So though we, of course, are going to be seeing a lot of increased access because folks now have insurance, and so there's more providers out there that they can be seen by, the infrastructure for that hasn't necessarily yet been built to provide quality access and culturally competent access for the community. So I would say, yes, it's a major milestone with the ACA to be able to improve the access, but we still have a lot of work to do in terms of what that access actually looks like for our community.
Thanks. Mm-hmm. I know you've got some numbers.
I have some context and some framing that I'll throw on top of what Elizabeth said. The Center for American Progress, based out of Washington, D.C., has been really at the forefront of a lot of the Affordable Care Act before it passed, since it passed, making sure that implementation is going well and is going equitably, especially for LGBT people. They did some research. They did some focus groups with LGB-identified people and transgender-identified people to find out what people's impressions were of the Affordable Care Act, what kind of apprehensions they had, and those kind of things. What they found was really interesting. They found that among the lesbian, gay, and bisexual group, folks in that group typically had the same kind of attitudes that the general heterosexual non-transgender population had. They were, you know, asking about subsidy rates and asking about, how far will I have to, you know, will I be able to keep the doctor that I have? Those kind of typical questions. But the transgender group was on an entirely different orientation. Their concerns focused around mistrust of the system, focused around, am I going to be able to get transition-related care covered? Will I still have to be kind of scrimping and saving to afford particular procedures? Will I be able to access care without discrimination, both from the provider perspective and from the insurance perspective? So it's really significantly different. So I think we've all kind of conspired that we're going to focus today on transgender community and individuals and issues. So I'll use that as the kind of background, and this is kind of where people are coming from, and the reasons why are there are significant and discrete and knowable barriers to health for transgender people, which I have written down here and I will list for you. First being economic marginalization. Through the process of transition, many people lose access to family support, community support. Many people, because of job discrimination, are not able to get jobs, retain jobs, be promoted in jobs, which largely pushes especially transgender women and especially transgender women of color into the margins of society economically. A lot of people are coerced economically into participating in sex work and the drug trade, which are not fields that carry health benefits with them. So this is one barrier to health is being kind of pushed to the margins. Another thing is health insurance exclusions. It's industry standard in all over the country to have deep in your plan documents somewhere some kind of line about, oh, and there will be no coverage provided for. They'll say any number of things. There's no standardized language. They might say transgender surgery, gender transition. Once I saw gender transformation, which I really like. I would like to see what that looks like. But in any case, they won't cover it, you know, so it doesn't really matter. And this is, there's nothing prohibiting these companies from doing this, except in certain states if there have been explicit laws passed. It could be public accommodations, non-discrimination laws. In some cases, like in California, there's a specific law targeting insurance. It's called the Insurance Gender Non-Discrimination Act, passed in 2006 here. And then there are, you know, the state regulatory agencies that oversee the insurance companies will issue bulletins clarifying to the insurance companies, no, you cannot discriminate. Here's what constitutes discrimination. And most of them basically make an argument around parity, that if an insurance plan covers, for example, hormone replacement therapy for a woman in menopause, they have to also cover it for a transgender person. You can't deny coverage for the same procedure, the same treatment, just for the reason that the person is transgender. So economic marginalization, health insurance exclusions, then there's a provider shortage overall, with Elizabeth talked about already, about this issue of cultural competence. Fourth, I would say, is internalized oppression. From being pushed to the margins economically, socially, culturally, there is a lot of mental health challenges that go along with that, which there's research now that points to risk behaviors and that being associated with self-esteem and all these kinds of things, which, you know, the health outcomes are very serious. If you're if you feel less secure with yourself, you're more likely to engage in activities that are high risk for HIV transmission, hepatitis, things like that. Fifth is, I said six before, but I combined two of them, so I will stop at five, is at the level of health system operations. And Elizabeth talked a little bit about this already. But basically, if you think about any time you go to the doctor or you think about going to the doctor, there's all these levels that you go through. If your documentation matches up with who you are, you generally don't have any problems between calling the appointments line, getting assigned to a provider or choosing your provider, checking in at the provider's office the day of, getting called back to, you know, get your vitals done, and then all those points of transfer between if it's a medical assistant or a nurse, then to your nurse practitioner or doctor, and then if there's any referrals to specialists, even if it's just to get your eye exam within the same thing. Every time someone looks at your name or your gender marker, most of us take this for granted that, okay, everything's smooth. But if you're a transgender person, many of us don't have ID that matches who we are. And so this can be, you know, it can range from just being uncomfortable to being downright dangerous. If you are outed in a waiting room where there are people who are hostile, you know, people have had unfortunate confrontations, and sometimes it's, you know, with the providers themselves. So this cultural competence issue is about the interpersonal, and it's also about the information systems. I will stop. I've said a lot of things.
while you digest all that, I'm going to ask a question to Maddie. Up until now, severe discrimination, and we've heard a little bit about that, against trans people has often stopped people from getting necessary preventative care and treatment for common conditions and diseases. How does this improve under healthcare reform, or can it get worse?
Yeah, so to take a step back, never eat spicy salsa right before doing a public speaking gig. The The Affordable Care Act is a lot of things, but it also is not a lot of things. So the Affordable Care Act is, to some degree, a compromise that we landed with, which is not universal health care, nor is it universal rules that apply everywhere. We're still left with a patchwork of coverage in this country. And so just to kind of add to the previous question quickly and just kind of set up my response to this, there is no one way to do it. And I think that one barrier that exists to people in the post-Affordable Care Act era is patient understanding of what is available and how to access that and what isn't available, and having a realistic perspective on what is and isn't available. So that said, specifically with respect to preventive care, within the Affordable Care Act, there are provisions that prevent exclusion based on pre-existing conditions, and there are provisions that require preventive care to be covered across the board. So what happens in law, de jure, and what happens de facto in the real world are two different things. And we live in a little bit of a bubble here in California, and I think we have to remember that there are people who are in the middle of the country and who are in states where there's a bit of a different political and social landscape, and they may have difficulty accessing services that are guaranteed to them by the Affordable Care Act, but you know, there might be three hoops that they have to jump through. And those hoops might be a challenge for a population of people who are already marginalized in healthcare. And this is not just transgender people. This is anybody on the LGBTQIA spectrum. People are marginalized already. Some of these exams involve sensitive areas. People are uncomfortable with their genitals if they're transgender. Some lesbians may be uncomfortable having pap smears. So these are some of the challenges I think that still exist, is we have kind of the baseline policy in place, but now we have to actually enact it. You know, do we have programs and funding that are going out there and are linking people into these preventive services, and the services are provided in a fashion and in a setting that is culturally appropriate?
Okay. I'm going to ask Elizabeth, we're hearing stories of now insured trans people getting their getting rejected for coverage for routine procedures because their gender is supposedly incompatible with needing that procedure. Have you seen that? Heard about that? Seen bad outcomes?
So at Lyon Martin, in terms of generally covered, I'm trying to think of specific examples around things that we otherwise would be covered, but because of their trans identity, there is a lot of times we have to resubmit bills for folks who, if we slip up and put their actual gender that they want us to put on the bill itself, will be rejected back to us saying, no, you can't provide that type of service like a pap smear to a male. And so it requires so many workarounds in order to be culturally competent for our clients, because everything is based on their billing gender. And so we have to flip everything to bill, and then it comes back to us, we flip it back to be culturally competent, and then we flip it back to rebill, because it's the amount of workaround that we have to do because other systems aren't created around this is really the bigger issue. That part of it doesn't impact patients. The piece where it really impacts patients, well, at least for our clinic, I would say generally it does. They get a bill, and it's a very disrespectful bill. That's really what it is. But for clients who the law states that they are entitled to hormone replacement therapy and access to specific surgeries, the law is there. They have a right to that, but health plans and third-party payers, insurance carriers, aren't contracting with surgeons, and they're actively denying hormones. We are constantly submitting for prior authorizations and then independent medical reviews for client after client with new coverage, because it's just getting denied, and the carriers don't have any due process yet to have it be the norm.
Great. Thank you. I'm going to shift gears for just a minute and ask about healthcare for queer people, especially for trans people, needs to be able to provide health services that address the needs of populations that have been historically severely discriminated against in multiple ways and places. A lot of times we think of that as mental health care needs, but it ranges a spectrum of needs related to problems that people have experienced because of the discrimination that they've been subjected to. Can you describe some of the services needed and whether they're maybe more available now compared to before healthcare reform?
So, you know, I think the first thing with respect to transgender patients that we should clarify is these services are medically necessary, not just based on, you know, I think the elephant in the room is, you know, why are we paying for all these plastic surgeries for people and why are we paying for hormones? You know, this is something that they choose to do. And I think it's important to state that that's an elephant that exists out there. And then we have to unpack that. You know, there is a wealth of data that shows that providing hormone therapy by itself, hormone therapy and surgery combined, or surgery by itself, all improve a range of psychosocial functioning outcomes. So we're making people's lives better, and quality of life is the kind of the endpoint outcome that you're always looking at. So, you know, when you're starting, nobody's done the cost analysis of, you know, are you saving money by giving somebody hormones because you're reducing their reliance on mental health and substance abuse services later? Maybe, maybe not. But most likely, yes. So we have to kind of just put out there that this stuff has actually been studied and it does improve quality of life. So it's not just a subjective kind of thing. the range of services that are now available to be covered in some settings that transgender people would seek, first would be hormone therapy. So, and other services that transgender people may seek include a variety of different surgical procedures, both on their genitals as well as on their face, their body, their breasts, and, you know, we can kind of go into more, I think you're going to talk in maybe a little more detail about those, but the point that I wanted to make is that transgender people may choose some of these treatments, may not choose some of these treatments. It's really up to the individual of which treatments they choose to seek. If they choose not to seek certain treatments, it doesn't make them less trans or less valid otherwise. But these things have all been identified as medically necessary by the World Professional Association for Transgender Health Standards of Care. And as we move through the post-ACA funding landscape, more and more policies, state and local governments are starting to recognize this and they're beginning to, in the patchwork way we do things in this country, mandate coverage for these services.
I'll add on other services that are frequently sought are mental health services, both for undertaking the psychological transformation, I said before, of becoming yourself in a new gender, in a destination gender, and also for the purpose of seeking treatment for trauma that that people undergo, both from, you know, from the psychological impact of confining your gender identity to this kind of repressed area of the mind, as well as the very real effects of discrimination. Many people face violence from family, from acquaintances, from strangers, street harassment. A colleague of mine who was in the room and actually just walked out gave me a wonderful example once of she was escorting a transgender woman from, it was maybe two blocks. It was maybe two blocks. And in those two blocks, she had been solicited, she had been yelled at, she had been, you know, someone asked, oh, are you a man or woman, or that's a man, you know, and that's in a two-block walk on one day, you know, and if you go through that every day, your entire life, that builds up, and anybody who experiences street harassment knows what that's like. So category women, category people of color, we know what this is like, and we know that this makes you feel not just unwelcome, but unsafe, and you end up building up these defenses, right, to go through life. So I'm digressing a little bit, but so mental health is to the purpose of it is one, yes, for transition, and two, to deal with not what's happening internally, but what's happening out there, Some folks also seek vocal training, especially for transgender women. It's difficult. You know, if you're a transgender man, you take testosterone, your voice drops. Okay, done. If you're a transgender woman, your voice doesn't rise automatically. So you have to learn, you know, if it is important to a particular person, to adapt your vocal style, which requires training. Other things people seek?
Basic primary care.
Of course.
which is really where, you know, at Lyon Martin, and when we do our clinical rotations with new providers that are coming through and getting their training with us, what they actually learn is how to integrate trans health into their primary care. And that's really when it becomes a safe space. Because it's not about you being trans, it's about you getting health care. And so I think in the way in the future, when I dream up my ideal world, it is just incorporated into primary care. That's where I would like to see it go. Great. But right now, it's about creating safe space. And we have patients that come in and start crying. They fly in. We have patients from all over the country because they don't have access to care where they are from. And they come in and start crying because they feel safe. They are reflected among other clients and among staff. And they can't believe that a place like that exists. So...
So I'm going to ask a question to add right onto that, mm-hmm. and then we'll hear everybody's point of view. The Affordable Care Act includes training health providers in culturally competent care, including LGBT competencies. So what? It's early, but have you seen any results of that training? And what kind of training is needed? And what kind of training works? And I'm going to start with you again because you brought it up.
So there's a collaboration between Lyon Martin and Transgender Law Center of Project Health, where we do provide trainings both to medical providers, some who are students and very new in their practice, and sometimes to others who are well established in their practice but just want to learn the care. So a piece of this program is a clinical rotation within Lyon Martin. And really the goal is, like I said, where you're just trying to teach the provider how to incorporate trans health into their general practices and not make it this specialty that it has kind of become in some arenas. And it's really successful. A lot of people who have gone through our clinical rotation have moved on and are now in clinics around the country and have started their own, quote, trans clinics. But really what they're doing is just starting to provide care to trans people. And then community talks, and they're like, oh, have you heard of provider so-and-so? They are great. And then they just become known for providing that care. So that element of provider training is really great. Unfortunately, that's very consumer-led, so we have students who are just really interested in providing trans care that come to us. It's not that their schooling is actually urging them to incorporate this care into what they're learning. And so what I think it would be really wonderful within any practice, whatever schooling you're going into, incorporating trans care into the primary care model and having that be a part of the curriculum and not, it's usually these like little side special classes that providers will take while in school if they're interested in it, but having that be a piece of core curriculum I think would be a probably more effective place for in terms of rapid spread.
Maddie, you're on the faculty of the medical school. any thoughts on what training works?
Well, we don't have enough time for the 2 hours that I could go on about the deficits in training that are available for transgender care. In 2010, I believe it was, there was an article published in JAMA by a colleague of mine at UCSF, Juno Obadin-Maliver, and her colleagues who studied curriculum content of 100 and some odd medical schools who responded to this survey. And only 27% of curriculums, I think it was 20-something percent, included any content on gender transition. So we have a huge gap in that area. So speaking purely from a curriculum-based perspective, it's just not there. The program that Lyon Martin has is fantastic and gives great exposure. And in my previous incarnation, when I was running a transgender health program at a large community clinic, I also had a clinical training experience for students and residents, and just people who were out in their careers and wanted to come in and learn about trans care. But, you know, our capacities are limited. And, you know, so at the University of California here in San Francisco, we also are developing training experiences that would match up with our range of services that we've developed with me providing primary care, and we have some surgical services that have come online and also some pediatric services as well. So we're in the process of developing that, but again, we are one institution and we're going to have limited capacity with an intense internal demand. There's a long waiting list of people who are waiting to get into this. So we really need that to happen. And really where it drives all of this stuff, and I want to talk broader LGBT, I don't want to just limit this discussion to trans on this particular issue, is policy and funding. Because health education is dependent on funding. I mean, medical education is dependent on funding. Fellowships, time for residents, this is all funding-based. So what really needs to happen is, you know, it's really great to put out a report from the Institute of Medicine making a call for a wide range of research in LGBT health and for calls to come out from Health and Human Services and the Institute of Medicine for training in all of these areas, but there has to be policy and there has to be funding to back it up. And that has not arrived yet. So the funding and capacity has lagged behind the mandate and the kind of stated vision and goals. So that's really what's important. And if I can just make one kind of corollary to that, talking about policy and funding priorities, you know, I do want to mention that there are perceptions, because of the way funding exists, that gay men's health is HIV, and that lesbian health is obesity and tobacco, and that bisexual health is depression, and that transgender health is a number of the issues that we've talked about here. But the reality is that everybody under our umbrella faces a whole range of issues, primarily around cultural sensitivity, that have to be addressed. And when we allow the funding landscape and the policy to be the tail that wags the dog of our practice and the way that we interact with the health system, we wind up with these perpetuated stereotypes in training, where because the funding is gay men's health is HIV, lesbians are all obese and smoking. So then that gets put into the curriculum. And in your medical school, you learn that when you have a lesbian patient, you have to ask her about smoking and obesity. And that's all that you do. And so we're missing the bigger picture of getting people to put their thinking caps on and look at the data and look at things like pap smear screening in lesbian populations. You know, maybe we need to look at other issues in gay men's health population, anal health and substance abuse and family planning all across the board. So I think we have to kind of take a look at the policy and the funding and try to push back against that and try to change that as well.
Any last thoughts on training? Is that
it's an exciting horizon, but I haven't seen it realized from the Affordable Care Act funding. I have heard of things happening in surprising places. I was just in Michigan recently, and some friends of mine are involved now in the Southeast Michigan Trans Health Council, which is super exciting because nothing like that has existed there before. And through a particular grant with the state, they have been tasked with making a curriculum for nurses specifically around transgender health. So things are popping up in different places, but it's piecemeal, and it's not comprehensive, and it's certainly not coming to a place where there are required cultural competency trainings or, you know, required benchmarks for any medical providers, which I think would be a good way to do things.
Thank you. So I'm going to go to a question from the audience, and please do bring them on. This question for Maddie. How long does it normally take to transition sexually? And the part of the question I really like is, do healthcare needs diminish to mirror the general population after that transition period?
That's a great question. The second question is an even better question. So the first question, when people say to transition sexually, I'm assuming that they mean to undergo a physical transition and not a more of a meta-sexual transition where you are thinking differently about your body in a sexual context after you transition and have a new body. It's an interesting question, and it brings up the question, the concept of transition having a, like a start, a middle, and an end. And that's not necessarily the case. And historically, there had been a, you know, kind of this narrative, which is you identify as trans, and so you go and you seek a therapist, and you work with them for some time. They diagnose you as trans. You go then to get hormones, and after you complete hormones, you go and have surgery, and then you have surgery, and now you are complete, and you are now a man or a woman, and it's done, and you move on. And none of those are necessary nor sufficient to arrive at a, what is considered a complete transition. I don't know that any of us, trans or not, ever get to a place in life where you're like, I'm just done. And I don't have anything else to learn, and I won't have any more personal growth. So, you know, that said, transgender people will have kind of a menu of things that they may or may not want to do, and then they're going to get to a place where they're going to say, huh, I feel like I am me. And then, like most things in life, 5 years later, they may wake up and say, oh, I actually think I want to now go somewhere else. So, you know, to kind of, so that's a little bit of a roundabout way. I mean, if people really, you know, really want to know, you start taking hormones, usually within 18 months to 2 years, you've seen the majority of the kind of physical changes that you would see with hormones. And without getting into too much of the details, some things can change, some things change less so. Some of it depends on the age at which the person is when they started. The second part of the question, which was, you know, is there a regression back towards the general population's general health risk profile after transition? So it's not an easy question to answer because we haven't had a ton of research. We have some data that comes out of Europe that is mostly retrospective data that tells us that in the long term, transgender people do not have mortality that differs from the general population. In general, there are some, you know, fine points here and there, but in general, for all intents and purposes, it's not significantly different. When you start getting into things of transgender women, so someone who transitions from male to female, do they have the same risk of breast cancer as someone who is not transgender and is female? We don't know. We think it's less. But again, we haven't had enough research to kind of to follow that out. So what we generally recommend is that transgender people, after they've kind of landed in their new gender world, is that you plug them into the general screening recommendations that exist for whatever organs they have to happen to have. So if they have breasts then and a prostate, then you would screen them for both of those things. If they have a cervix, but they don't have breasts, well, then you might not screen them for breast cancer, but you still would do a pap smear. So unfortunately, we don't have a ton of data, but the kind of the one sentence answer is this stuff is really not, nothing is blipping up on the radar that's saying that this is dangerous or that there are significant inequalities in health outcomes in the long term between the groups.
Thank you. And take a moment to remind our radio audience, you're listening to the Commonwealth Club of California radio program. Tonight's discussion is the Affordable Care Act and the LGBT community, underwritten by the California Wellness Foundation. Our panelists are Elizabeth Sequeira, RN and Clinic Director for Lyon Martin Health, Dr. Maddie Deutsch, Clinical Lead for the Center of Excellence for Transgender Health at UCSF, and Anand Kalra, Program Manager at the Transgender Law Center. I'm Dr. Barry Zevin, Clinical Lead for the San Francisco Department of Public Health Transgender Health Project and your moderator for tonight. I'm going to ask our panel about the... I think we've heard repeatedly about how we're missing data. ACA has promised a focus on data collection for LGBT populations and the needs of LGBT people. Collecting data on trans people has been especially challenging in our system that only recognizes a rigid male-female binary for gender identity. Can you talk about best practices in the area of data collection?
Sure.
So I can speak briefly, and then I want to give my co-panelists a chance to speak as well. But I've recently published two papers on the subject of data collection in transgender populations. One was a set of recommendations from the World Professional Association for Transgender Health Electronic Medical Records Working Group, which I co-chaired, which was a set of recommendations on how to collect data on transgender patients and how to put it into the electronic medical record. There's a spillover here into lesbian, gay, and bisexual health issues, too, because we need to also be collecting sexual behavior information. In this day and age, you can't just say to somebody, are you gay, bi, lesbian, with respect to sexual orientation, because there's a lot more. We need to know who's having sex with who and what's going where. And transgender people have different organs, so someone may be a gay male, but their partner is a transgender male, so their partner doesn't have a penis, perhaps, and but they're still a gay male. So it's really, so we have to really unpack this in the right way. Getting back to the data collection issue with transgender people, we have to remember that if we don't collect data on transgender people, then we can't research transgender people, we can't allocate funding to transgender concerns. The most recent data that has been published demonstrates that the population of transgender people in this country is in the 0.5% range, which is roughly equivalent to the population of Hawaiian Pacific Islanders in the United States, based on the 2010 census. So that said, there's a process that's recommended that more and more people are doing now, which is effectively a best practice for collection of gender identity information, which is referred to as the two-step process. So people have probably seen things where it says, what is your sexual orientation, gay, bi, lesbian, transgender? Transgender is not a sexual orientation. But then you might also see something where it says sex, male, female, transgender. Well, so I'm transgender, I'm male to female transgender. I might look at that and say, well, I identify as female, I'm a woman, but I also am trans, I want to make sure that I'm counted, but I can only choose one. So the two-step process, what it allows us to do is you identify the person's gender identity, which can be male, female, it could be transgender woman, transgender man, it could be gender queer or other gender nonconforming, and then you identify their birth sex, their sex assigned at birth. Anybody whose birth assigned sex and gender identity are different is transgender, and you can write the easiest computer program in the world to query and pick that out. So that's the recommendation. A study was done by a team at SF State, and they found that when they used the two-step method in a similar population to a one-step method, two populations, they identified twice as many transgender people, and it was 1.65% versus, I think, 0.75% or something. So they're picking, you're catching more transgender people. And the last plug is that I will say, or last comment I'll make, is we published a study that we conducted of providers of transgender care looking at how do they collect this information. And the results were all over the board. There's no standardization whatsoever. They're storing it here, they're doing that, they're collecting pronoun, they're not collecting this. So we have a lot of work that has to be done with respect to getting best practices out there and standardizing this.
Yeah. So I want to let everyone comment on this, and I want to open it up a little bit more to the question about electronic health records. Electronic health records are a topic near and dear to all of our hearts.
Dear and, is a strong word.
Yeah, exactly. And for many of us who have been practicing in settings that made adaptations to be able to have better cultural competency in this area, in the paper chart era, we had our way of doing it that actually helped. A lot of the time now, it feels like the electronic health record feels kind of like a step backwards. So if you can comment on that as well as the data, that would be great.
Yes. It is really hard because who's really responsible for the electronic health records, unfortunately, is not the providers, it's the vendors and who is selling the product to purchase for your electronic health record. And there is no perfect purchase, as somebody who has scoured the earth for the perfect purchase and ended up with nothing so far. And so instead, what we have to do is, again, create so many workarounds. And some EHRs have even developed these wonderful things where you put in male because that's what their insurance card says, even though they may identify as female. And then it even pops up with a little blue circle with an arrow to identify, or with a cross to identify whatever their billing gender is, just in case we needed to know. So they've hyper-genderized an incorrect gender on there. There's also no fields for preferred name as to, opposed to their billing name. So we have to create a workaround so our clients, so we can call them by the name that they should be called by. There's obviously no two-step process to identify their current identity and or assigned sex at birth. And so it's really unfortunate because you have to be in the know to be able to correct it and create the workarounds to provide competent care. And really what should be happening is these EHRs inform providers across the world, really. And they direct the provider on the standard of care. They have put so much time and energy on giving you these really wonderful templates. I put in this, and I'm now screening for A, B, C, and D, and after I click those boxes, I'm going to go right to this. So it is actually directing the care that a lot of providers are providing. And so if the vendors were to kind of take a step back and work with their clients around this, and the hope is that, you know, as the government takes more of an interest in collecting the data, that they'll take this more seriously, is that really the EHR will direct the care. It will give them all of this information in advance, and you don't have to have, you know, special training sessions for GLBT healthcare because the information system is already there giving you what you need. It won't teach you how to, you know, look somebody in the eye and, you know, and do all of the other things that you need to be going to school for, but in terms of information systems teaching our providers, that's really how it should be going. That's my hope anyway. Great.
Any thoughts on data collection and EHRs?
Just one. I mean, it's sitting between the experts on the issues, so it's great to kind of hear you in person instead of just reading your papers. But the other thing that I think Elizabeth is talking about also is that this is all, it's all market driven. It's, you know, it's follow the money. So most of the places that transgender people seek care are community clinics, small places with small and shrinking budgets, with not a lot of buying power. Larger systems have much more ability to negotiate with vendors about, you know what, I'm not going to buy this from you because you're not actually meeting my needs because I have a large transgender population. This doesn't tend to happen. The exception can be in university health systems. A lot of people, you know, at some university health systems, they have specific carve-out programs for transgender, they'll call them like comprehensive transgender services or things like that. And also at college campuses, at the student health centers, we tend to see more trans-identified people than the general population in college campus settings. So in those circumstances, there's more buying power and there's more opportunity. So I forget who I was just talking to recently, but they were at one of these large systems and they were saying, hey, you know, we really actually want to get good EHR. And I was so excited because if one big system does it and gets the vendor to build what they need, then suddenly the function is there and other people can use it as well. Mm-hmm.
That's great. Thanks. I'm going to take some of the audience questions now, which are really, really good. It's a question for anyone who wants to answer it. Do you think TV shows and movies like Orange is the New Black have significantly improved cultural competency?
I think it's improved awareness, and it's improved people's interest and people's willingness, especially with Laverne Cox's performance in Orange is the New Black. You get to see a transgender person as a whole person instead of a joke, instead of a body part. And that is really significant in shifting people's perspectives. So often, when we do work, you know, out in the community trying to shift public perception, or even doing legislative work and working with legislators or their staffers, the stereotypes that people have had have been very difficult to overcome. You know, stereotypes around trans women being sex workers, being drug seeking, being really just men as in dresses, and not having a sense of a person as a whole person. So I think that kind of this wave of trans awareness that we're on right now is very valuable in that it allows us to plug in. You know, those of us who've been doing the substantive work for as long as we've been doing it, to plug in and say, yes, now you see people as real people, and here are more of the issues. There is a temptation, I think, of the public imagination to think that once there is, once we've reached a critical threshold of this many households in America know what a transgender person is, or you know, have a particular vocabulary around trans issues, then, oh great, now we're done, and aren't we glad that equality has been reached? But really, just being aware of who a person is the very, very, very minimal bottom step before you can get people to start caring about issues like police brutality and over-incarceration and solitary confinement that the show brings up, but doesn't have policy connections to. You know, there's it would that it were that you could watch Netflix and then there's little action buttons that you can do, you know, contribute to Casa Ruby and you know, write to your legislator. Would that that were integrated, but I don't think the political machinations would work well with Netflix's business model.
Thank you. I love that. We've been talking a lot about medical. We've got a question here as far as what's the role of dental health? Is dental even relevant to this discussion about LGBT?
I would say dental is relevant to the entire United States. I mean, that is historically one of the issues that everyone has had such a hard time accessing dental. And in California specifically, funding was pulled a few years ago within Medi-Cal, and so everyone who used to have dental no longer did, and we're still waiting for them to reinstate that. And it is so difficult to access dental care regardless of any identity that you have. And it is a real medical issue. I mean, everyone knows dental health impacts lots of other systems, and it's an important part of healthcare prevention. So I wouldn't specifically pinpoint the GLBT community within dental health. That's a larger issue of prioritization, again, with funding.
I think the degree to which LGBT people may be more economically marginalized than the general population, not more marginalized than every other marginalized population, but versus the general population. Yeah. So low-income people in general having a harder time with that. Mm-hmm.
I think it's a great question. And as we've done trainings in the Department of Public Health, it's really easy to forget our dental health providers. And then they've come to us and said, we want the training. It's like, oh, yeah, we've got to make sure that people who are working with people in an intimate way, which dental absolutely is, mm-hmm. have this cultural competency and cultural humility all across the line, and that it's another one of those services that if we can do that, we can really decrease the disparity and get some equity for people. So thank you for that question. At this point, I'm going to ask people to start to think about describing what works. I'm going to have some particular questions, but the next little bit is really about what direction are we going in, what really works, where should we be headed? And the first one is a question from the audience. What are the research priorities for trans health?
Well, I would say first and foremost is we need more outcome data, and we need prospective outcome data. We need to take a cohort of, you know, a group of transgender people with a variety of characteristics, you know, female to male to female, different ethnicities, different ages, and we need to follow them for 30 years. And we need to just collect a ton of data. We need to turn every public health student loose on this population's database. We need to go in and figure out health outcomes, disparities. We need to look at different predictors of bad outcomes. We just need to collect a huge ongoing prospective database. And so the corollary to that is improving the way we count transgender and lesbian, gay, bisexual people through improved data collection practices, better identifying who is LGBT so that we can then connect that parameter, that variable, to the rest of who they are, so that we can go into the U.S. Census or into Kaiser's database or into you know, the VA system, all these huge databases of patients, and say, I'm going to pull out, you know, I want to know about, you know, African-American lesbians who are between 40 and 60 and live in a state, you know, in the East Coast. You know, we need to build it. We can't do that right now. So, you know, I can't just go run a query at UCSF saying, give me all the lesbian patients you've had, or I want to know all the, because it's going to spit back people who are lesbians. It's going to spit back people who are transgender, but we're not, it's not a complete set. So that would be kind of what I would say, but I'm sure that there are millions of priorities that mm-hmm. others would.
Those are great ones. So Maddie earlier referenced the Institute of Medicine has issued this very comprehensive, large report about the kind of the state of LGBT health research and what needs to be done and what can be done. One of their major recommendations is that every study includes the two-step process for counting transgender people and also a measure for counting sexual orientation and sexual behavior, which, if you think about that, that kind of shifts things in a different way, where now we can look at every research study that's coming out about everything and then focus in on sexual behavior, on gender identity. That would be pretty powerful. We might find that only in very large-scale studies would we get any sample sizes with statistical significance, but even being able to measure and say, oh, there were 5 people in this 300-person sample, that's more than we expected, you know. That would be at least something.
Great, thank you. In May 2014, the federal government removed the exclusion of sex reassignment surgery for coverage by Medicare. And I want to ask, what does this mean for people covered by Medicare and for those with Medicaid and other insurances? And when you answer that, think about how you could redesign. How you would redesign ACA, what provisions would you put in it to make a difference in the issues we're talking about tonight?
Anyone mind if I jump in on that one?
Sure.
Okay, thanks. Mm-hmm. So Medicare lifting, so little context of what happened. So in the late 70s, transgender people had been trying to get transition-related care covered through Medicare. And at the time, Medicare issued this statement saying that this was experimental and therefore they weren't going to cover it. And that stayed on the books until this year, until a few months ago. So what was a very archaic and outdated policy finally, for once, got overturned. What the particular policy does is it lifts the ban. It does not necessarily mean that that's a mandate for coverage, and particularly with, you know, all the kind of different ways that Medicare is administered in different areas, it's not necessarily an affirmative drop all the barriers, everybody run straight forward kind of a thing. Similar to what we're seeing here in California with we have the Insurance Gender Non-Discrimination Act, we have regulations on it. And yet, you know, things aren't changing at the level of you call the customer service representative and you say, I'd like to get my procedure covered. And they say, oh, no, we don't cover that, even though they do. So there's this difference. There's this whenever we're interacting with insurance companies, there's the smiley front face, and then there's the, well, I don't know what I want to call the rest of it. I don't want to disparage the people who are working there. But there's this disconnect. And we can speculate as to whether it's intentional or not. For example, Anthem Blue Cross issued this statement a few months ago clarifying that, yes, their plans will comply with the law and regulations. Yes, they will provide coverage for this, this, and this. But historically, Anthem is one of the companies that, when you're advocating for your patients, you have to fight the most with them and submit the most documentation. So there's this kind of left-hand, right-hand kind of thing going on. I am anticipating that we will see similar things with Medicare. Another issue, of course, is that the Medicare reimbursement rates are quite low. So primary care, you know, many primary care doctors don't take Medicare. Hospitals take Medicare. That's great, but, you know, hopefully your first point of contact isn't a hospital. Medicaid is an even more kind of entrenched and entangled and twisted up issue because of the dual nature of its administration being a federal program that's administered state by state, and then within each state, different county procedures, whether this county is using HMO models, managed care, whether this county is using straight fee-for-service where they have a particular amount of money per patient from the state per year. It gets really, really messy in the details. It's hard to say exactly what this will look like for people. Until four years ago, when basically no insurance company was covering this stuff unless you had a special rider that you were paying individually for, the situation used to be transgender people's questions would be directed towards providers, and they say, "Will you provide my treatment?" And the provider would say, "How much money do you have?" Because it was a cash model, it was pay out of pocket. Now the situation is more that they're asking questions to the provider or to a service or to a social service agency or to their insurance company. There's no more unified way of asking questions. And the question that they're asking is, "Will you cover my treatment?" And the answer to that is, "How much time do you have?" Because it's going to take hours to figure out what your situation is. Do you have an employer-sponsored plan? Is it a covered California plan? Who's the regulator? And based on who the regulator is, what's your appeal channel? Because we're anticipating that, you know, pretty much across the board, people are still going to be getting denials of care from the insurance company, hopefully in advance of a procedure, and hopefully not, you know, after the procedure's happened. And then have to appeal internally with the insurance company, appeal with the state channels. If it's a federally regulated plan, try with the Department of Labor. It's just messy, and it's not what people want to hear. You know, they want to have a clear answer. Can I plan my next year? Can I plan my finances for the next year? Do I need to be scrimping and saving? Or can I be assured that this insurance plan that I have that I either pay for or that I paid into by being a taxpayer will provide the care that I need that's medically necessary, that the American Medical Association and the American College of Obstetrics and Gynecology and the American Endocrine Society have all said is medically necessary. That might be
thank you
more than you wanted.
So I want to before we get to the lightning round, I want to ask people to expand their thinking on to the global level on this. It's fair to say that most of the gains in GLBT rights have resulted directly from activism and engagement by the communities themselves. How can GLBT and specifically trans communities get more directly involved in the changes we've been talking about, needing to improve health? And particularly, how do we talk about that when we're talking about huge variations as we look at different countries around the world, different regions around the world?
That's a big question.
It's time to dream. It's a big question.
This is a big question. I mean, I think on the small level, you know, to take this at the micro level, transgender people need to become more involved in their own care, their own advocacy, their own policy making, just like many other subpopulations, you know, or have their own ownership to some degree over their own population's needs and care. Now, that's not to say that we need to kick out people who aren't trans from doing this kind of work. And at the same time, it doesn't mean that there is a huge group of qualified transgender people waiting in the wings, because we know that transgender people are so disadvantaged and so disenfranchised. They don't have economic opportunity. They don't have education opportunity. So we have to really empower transgender people. I mean, this kind of goes hand in hand with UN development goals of empowering women and findings that when societies empower women, the measures of quality of life and measures of that society's general existence improve as well. So I think that that's kind of going from the micro now to the macro level is, you know, looking worldwide and remembering that what we say is trans here in our little microcosm in San Francisco, where we like play with gender and it's like a graduate level course, we have to remember that there are people in like in the Andean regions of South America, in Southeast Asia, in Australia, in Europe and in former Soviet republics, Africa, all over the world have different ideas about what gender is, and there are different roles that gender plays in that population. So, you know, when you do a study, or if you're looking at transgender people in different places, you kind of have to remember, well, what one person says is trans might be something totally different for another. So we have to engage local people on the ground to get that local perspective, get the local key informants involved.
Yeah. It has this general feeling whenever I'm speaking with folks who have positions of leadership, who are trans-identified, and talking with about their experience in being either corporate sector or not, their experience of being trans-identified. So meaning there's a lot of folks who will live as stealth, right? Like they transition, they don't identify as trans, they identify as their current gender, and they want to live their life. They don't want to necessarily get involved in activism or moving along the movement. And part of that is, I mean, A, it just needs to be respected, but B, it's really hard. It's really hard to exist with a trans identity. You're constantly being accosted with questions from people, caring people, but they're your coworkers, they're your co-leaders. And having to negotiate that while fighting for access to many, many things is really vulnerable and quite scary for many people. You run the risk of losing your job, of being the person in the room that nobody really wants to talk to because all they care about is this one thing. And it's so complicated that for me, the responsibility doesn't lie specifically with the trans community. The responsibility lies within the industries to change these things. So it's about employing people who are trans-identified and mentoring and giving them leadership opportunities and giving them positions of power to then create that change within.
Great. Thanks. We're getting to the point where I've got one last question for each of our panelists. And I think that I'm going to ask our panelists, this is a question from the audience, and I think it's a good one to work on wrapping up with. What do you think will be the most important change over the next few years in health policy that will affect the well-being of LGBT people?
The next few years are going to be all about implementing the Affordable Care Act and overcoming all of the court challenges. There was one case that was decided just the other day. I read the article this morning saying that for people who bought their insurance plans through the federal health exchanges versus the state-run ones, that the government isn't actually allowed to give them the subsidies, the tax credits, which is ridiculous. And many people are regarding this as, you know, just this Republican waste of time to delay things and to cause more confusion in the courts, which has been their successful strategy, you know, for the last 15 years on a number of issues. With only 3 minutes left, there's not a whole lot I can go into detail about there. But, you know, the changes are going to be, one, about maintenance. So kind of fighting against the entropy of these kind of court battles and that sort of thing. And two, hopefully we're going to see more proactive changes, especially regarding transgender health exclusions. There's now 8 states plus the District of Columbia that have state-level bulletins from the regulatory agencies. Hopefully we're going to see that move to more states, and hopefully we're going to see that actually change for people on the ground.
Yeah. And I think that if I can just bring this back to data collection, we have to be in 2020 census. LGBT has to, we got to collect that data. And then the second piece is other institutional recognition and validation of our existence and our entities. So employment non-discrimination, that's inclusive of gender identity. You know, when transgender people can, and LGBT people can get jobs, and they, you know, you can get fired in 33 states, I think, in this country currently for being gay or lesbian. So forget about trans. So I think institutional greater recognition and legitimization through policy change.
Great. You're working on the ground in a community health center. What's your vision of what's going to affect the well-being of LGBT people policy-wise?
So I think how the ACA went down in terms of states being able to choose whether or not to expand Medi-Cal or Medicaid is
is very scary to me in many ways, because it's creating a whole new disparity of care based on geography. And so folks in California who are low income now have access, though it is fighting for it, but it's there. We just have to figure out what those avenues are. Whereas folks in so many other states, that's just still a pipe dream in so many ways. And so, yes, it's maintaining the ACA in California, but also thinking about, wow, we're still getting all of these clients from across the country that they shouldn't have this disparity. You shouldn't have to choose where you live based on your diagnoses. So I would think that that's also, and data collection, data collection is just so big.
Well, I want to thank our panelists for a fantastic discussion. Our thanks to the California Wellness Foundation for underwriting this program, and to our panelists, our terrific panelists, Elizabeth Sakara, nurse and clinic director for Lion Martin Health, Dr. Maddie Deutsch, clinical lead for the Center of Excellence for Transgender Health at UCSF, and Anand Kalra, program manager at the Transgender Law Center. We also thank our audience here and on the radio and internet. Thank you very much. I'm Dr. Barry Zevin, and now this meeting of the Commonwealth Club of California is adjourned.